life's gone down the drain. Your body's wrecked with pain. There's just one thing to blame. Dynamite in the brain. Dynamite in the brain. Dynamite in the brain. Dynamite in the brain.
Thanks for listening. I'm Brian Smith, and I'm back from the dead. And this is episode 46 of Dynamite in the Brain, the podcast that loves anime and hates fun. As always, I'm joined by my co-host. He thinks he's a polar bear, but he's clearly a panda. It's Anthony Askew.
Hello.
And tonight, in order to keep up the Irish quotient we're aiming for this year, we are joined by Philip from Eepa's Choice Podcast.
Hello, everybody.
Good to have you, Philip.
Yeah. I mean, I figured Niall was getting lonely at this point.
And we're here to talk about another 2002 anime. In fact, this one's pretty close to being exactly 10 years ago. There, it was running 10 years ago, we'll say that. It's first aired April the 4th, 2002, and it's known by Magical Shopping Arcade Abenobashi. 13-episode series, directed by Hiroyuki Yamaga, and produced by Gainax and Madhouse. And I checked, it got released in America in 2004 and also got released in the UK late 2004.
Yeah, that was I think one of ADV UK's releases. I remember seeing it in my local Forbidden Planet years and years ago. I was like, oh, that looks like interesting, and just moving on to see if I could find another copy of Cyber City 080808.
So you never purchased... This
no, until you guys actually suggested this for a podcast, I'd never watched it. Here's a shameful thing. I own both volumes of the ADV manga, or the Tokyo Pop manga, and I read it and I was like, oh, that seems cool, but I never actually was that pushed to watch it. I really don't know why I didn't watch it before now. It's pretty good.
Don't spoil it yet. Can't early opinions.
It's not that much of a spoiler, Anthony, if I say, oh, it's really good.
Early opinions, nah.
I first saw it as probably one of the earliest digital fan subs I downloaded through WinMX. I think we're hitting the period now where a lot of these 2002 shows I was illegally downloading via a creaky peer-to-peer platform.
No. You were not illegally downloading. You were... making a consumer choice without actually knowing what moral choice you were really making.
And
that's what I'm sticking to when they bring me to trial, Brian.
Plan the head.
from this... Oh, you... I switched...
What's God, he damn, doing?
I'm blaming you this for Anthony, because I've now got an Apple software update wanting to happen. Wanted to update QuickTime. No, I'm recording a podcast. Leave me alone. I only saw the first 11 episodes. So I did not see the finale.
Is there a reason for that?
I might get to it as we discuss the episodes later on. But I don't think there's necessarily a reason for it. Maybe I just couldn't find the last two episodes, or maybe they were very good fan subbers and stopped it when it got licensed. They decided to not do the last couple
That's
of episodes.
Possible.
You really are an optimist, Brian.
I am, yes. It was the early days. I come from the time when people were, they were
moral,
honest, even though if you want to look in the rec arts anime in the 90s, you'll still see people complaining about fan subs there, saying, I think they're selling these tapes too expensively. They're making a profit off it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it wasn't until, when did ADV go under in the UK?
2008 or 2009. I know,
yeah, something
Hugh
around.
David. Yeah, I know Hugh David, the rep for ADV UK. He was over at Tartan Video by 2009 at least.
Yeah, so I stole the pennies from their dead eyes and I bought the entire series on DVD for 10 quid at NMC Expo that year when they were clearing out all the Lace were clearing out all the stock. And so I finally got to see the last two episodes. Which may have influenced my opinion, because I think if you look at a lot of the comments on it, people who sat and watched the entire series, they don't like the last episode very much.
Okay, I'm going to disagree with the internet.
Yeah, so am I, but we'll get to that later. Let's actually tell the listeners what the show's about. It is about two 12-year-old children, Arumi and Sashi, who find themselves in a variety of alternate realities based on various aspects of pop culture. That is the key selling point of the show. There's more to it than that, and we should get into that as we go. But first episode opens with them in their shopping arcade where their families have lived since the 50s. And it's being closed down. Sash is upset that his friend Arumi is going to be moving away. There's an accident involving Arumi's grandfather, Massa.
Yep.
And they find themselves, by the end of the episode, in a world of Dungeons and Dragons. Hmm. But without having to take a fairground ride to get there.
Very good, very good. Well, this whole show was new to me. As you say, you've seen it around. I've seen it in HMV. Kind of avoided it. Don't know why, but I did. And I didn't know what to expect. And then the first episode catches me off guard when the grandfather falls from that terrible bit of building work. And then I thought, oh, this is going to be good. I felt hooked at this point because I thought, oh, this is completely different than what I expected. And then they end up in Dungeons and Dragons land. At this point, it goes downhill for me. But go on, let's. but no, it goes up and down, but I'll not get there yet. Not quite yet.
I think I came to it being sold on it after Fooly Cooly. And I think people were saying, oh, some of the animators who worked on Fooly Cooly are working on this.
Can you see that, do you think?
Oh, yes, because by the time we get to episode three.
Definitely.
I mean, episode three, we'll talk about that in a minute. Anything else you guys want to say about episode one before we...
I love this, like the soundtrack. And for some reason, the soundtrack just moves away from this kind of atmospheric, you know, haunting music from when the granddad like falls off this building. And I was like, oh, this is, I don't know, it's just got the right mood, it's setting the mood. And then it never plays that same piece again until the last episode. I'm 100% of that. Because I made note of that piece of music mentally and it doesn't get played again. So I don't know, it kind of built me up for this, a very different show just from the first episode alone.
Now, I see. Because I knew about the dimension jumping and the pop culture thing before going in. And so, in fact, when I first saw the first episode, I was like, where's all the stuff I was sold on? Until the end of the episode comes around, in which case I was like, yay, this is what I was expecting.
I knew about the basic concept of the show from years and years ago, but I never actually watched it. I think I kind of lumped it in with FLCL, and I had no problem with FLCL. I love FLCL, but for some odd reason, it was like, if it's not going to be as crazy as FLCL, then I'm not really interested. And I didn't actually realize how, you know, the last, I think, before we get to the final episode and why the final episode is a bit, what do you want to call it, controversial? Before we get to that, yeah. There's like this period of the last three, maybe four episodes where everything literally races towards the end and just jams stuff on, you know, but like some sort of Frankenstein Lego set. They're just bolting stuff on, racing towards the end. And actually, I enjoy those episodes the most because in that block is the Hollywood episode. It's one of my favorite episodes.
Yes, yes.
But you were mentioning there a piece of music. I was sitting there kind of watching the instrumental pieces where, you know, where there would be nothing happening. There'd be very little dialogue, very little action. And I'm sitting there in the corner, are they playing Heart and Soul? And they're like one key off. I'm do, 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 do. And then they get the do low note. I was like, you cheap bastards, you couldn't possibly pay for the rights for Heart and Soul. And then it gets better because later on, the military episode that comes along, they take John Williams' score from 1941 and they play one note out from that and they run the entire episode. That, that's 1941 theme music over and over again on some endless loop. It's running this like.
But one note out.
Which one note out?
Yeah, there is. I'm sure there's a. I'm definitely 100% sure the Indiana Jones theme gets thrown in.
Yeah, in the Hollywood episode where finally Sashi breaks out his inner Indiana Jones. We get that theme music for about, I don't know, 5 seconds. It's good. It's brilliant. It's brilliant.
And that one note comes along and ruins it.
Now, one thing that I wanted to address, the setup we were talking about just now, the one thing we need to stress is Abenobashi takes place in the Osaka area. And for anyone who's a fan of Japanese animation of any kind, most people will know that whenever dubbing studios get their hands on an anime, they start to assign voices for, you know, different actors. There's one curious thing, however. For as long as I can remember, any time a character from Osaka is portrayed, usually people are portrayed in Osaka as being more like country bumpkins. And that's the way most anime portrays people from Osaka. But for some odd reason, dubbing studios have this weird predilection of, well, if they're country bumpkins, that means we have to give everyone from Osaka a Texan accent. I was like, wait, what? And I remember slipping between the English dub and the Japanese dub for this, and I was like, don't tell me they're going to make every single person from Abenobashi have a southern accent. Yeah, everyone has a southern accent. Everyone. And I was like, wow, really? Seriously? You're going to run the entire show like that? Okay, well, fine. If that's the way you want to play it.
Yeah, because I watched it with the like the show notes on, which they've got like pop-up notes come up on the Japanese subtitles on the ADV release, and they that points out when they switch between Japanese usage. So sometimes they're using Osaka usage, and sometimes they use normal Japanese usage, and then sometimes they use various other ones. Whether that may have some effect. I know they had one of the writers basically did like script touch up to make Osaka up the script. Yeah, Tetsuya Tanaka.
Having said that, like, they do treat everyone like a southern character, but there is that one episode where they go to how do I describe it? America Town. That's the only way I can describe it. And you know what I'm talking about. It's the hot dog vendor, and every second word in Japanese and in English is the word fucking. He's like, hey, how do you partner? Are you a fucking cowboy? Are you a fucking cowgirl? And I was like, they wouldn't have done that in the English, though, would they?
And they do. Because I only watched it entirely in the English dub, and I was actually mentioning this exact scene to Brian earlier before we started, and this really cracked me up. This is at a point where I was kind of indifferent about the show. It had its ups and downs. I was thinking, oh, come on, just finish already. Then this guy jumps in, the guy with the stubble, the 12 o'clock shadow, dropping F-bombs everywhere.
And it bang, was just bang, like, bang. Brilliant, great.
It is good.
It's interesting how the cast in Abenobashi doesn't change episode to episode. It's the same characters, the same vendors who are in the arcade at the beginning of the first episode are still there. They're just done in different iterations.
Well, kind of, but this is the thing I noticed watching it second time through, is that for like the first six episodes, episodes 2 to 6, as they're going through the worlds, an additional character from the real world appears as each episode goes along. Because I think in one of them, they go, oh, Dad, you're here as well. As if one of the dads hadn't been in it up to that point. And also I think the mums turn up later.
Yes,
straight
yeah,
away.
Yeah. Because when I think it's Sashi's mom turns up, in I think episode 9 or 10, I was like, I'd forgotten that she was in the show. Because she's in the first episode as Sasuke's real mom, and then she's in the dinosaur episode, and she's one of the background characters as his mom. But then she's not seen again for another, 4 or 5 episodes, and I had almost forgotten she was in the show.
Yeah, because I kind of actually want to go and watch it again now, having
really
thoughts about... Well, as I said before I started watching, I was watching bits of episode 1, bits of episode 7 and episode 13, for reasons I'll get into later, but there is... That thing about the characters not appearing and what we learn about one of the characters in the very last episode.
I think I know what you're referring to.
Makes me want to see how he behaves in the episodes he appears in.
I'm trying to find a gentlemanly way of segueing into the character of Mooney Mooney.
I just want to say something else about the Osaka accent. Because I have heard it also as Brooklyn in some dubs.
Brooklyn.
They've given them a Brooklyn. And I think, I don't know for sure, but I think the Crusader Catgirl Nuku Nuku dub, I think they give it a Liverpudlian accent.
Okay, I need to watch that dub right now. I'm sorry, I have to leave this podcast right now. Strangely enough, the only other time I've actually sat through a show where there was a definitive Osaka accent like that, as heavy as it is on Banabashi, is Burst Angel. And one of the characters is definitively from Osaka, and in the English dub, Funimation ascribed her a Texan accent. And it's a really thick, thick Texan accent. It's so thick you could slice bread with it. It's that thick.
Do they use Texan dubbing house like ADV do? Because I'm wondering whether that has a lot to do with it.
So spring in the local, it's fine.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, episode 2. I just want to talk about some of the people who worked on it. We can get to Mooney Mooney as we get to episode 2. So directed by Hiroyuki Yamaga. But there is another creative force working on it as scripting and also script supervision, and that is Satoru Akahori. Now, how familiar are you guys with his work?
Drop some names.
Okay, here's some key. He's very big in the 90s, and then he's done a fair amount in the 2000s as well. You've got NG Knight Ramoon, and 40. KO Century Beast Warriors.
Keep them coming.
Saber Marionette J.
Okay, I know of Marionette J. I just don't care about Marionette J.
Sorcerer Hunters.
I'm seeing a recurring theme, at least. I'm getting a theme. Yeah. But
and then more recently, what's the more recent work he's done? Kashimashi, Girl Meets Girl.
Rings bells.
He did a lot of work on Sakura Wars as well. But nice stuff. Big. He's the most 90s of 90s writers, in my opinion. Maze or Sorcerer Hunters is the most Akahori, and therefore the most 90s of 90s shows. Mm. He normally has like a theme. He'll like a theme named character, so every character will be named after a cake or a drink or something like that. Is cakes in Sorcerer Hunters, drinks in Ramoon, and I think it's fruit in Saber Marionette.
Jay. Yeah, I have his A&N listing here, and he worked on Tekkaman Blade as series composition writer, and he also worked on Video Girl Eye, which is a small treasure chest of an OVA series that I'm quietly keeping to myself, hoping the internet doesn't find out about it.
They used to know about it in the 90s, I'll tell you that. but yeah, he's kind of has a formula. You can almost see some of the formula in here. It's sort of, he'll tend to have the hero, there'll be a young girl character who's around the same age as the young hero. There'll normally be like two sexy older female characters. And there'll be normally at least one sort of gay or bi character.
I think you've just described about at least 60% of the cast in the Banabashi.
Yeah, pretty much. But because the thing I like to wind up people who like Melancholy of Harui Suzumiya and point out that the formula in that is basically the formula he was using all through the 90s in terms of the character layouts. So he wrote episode 2. He's well known enough that eventually in the 2000s he has a show which even has his name in the title. Mm-hmm. Which I can't find the translation. Akahori's Heretical Hour Love Game, which was basically 2 10-minute shows, one about two superheroes and one about a family of witches.
Okay.
He wrote episode 2, episode 3, episode 5 and 11. But you can see his influence in some of the other stuff, particularly 2 and 3. It's very...
Mm-hmm. Which one's 5? Don't say. I'm trying to find it. Yes.
Everyone's okay. Typing out episode lists on a quick...
Oh, I've got little notes, but between...
Yeah, so if you particularly the first half, 2, 3, and 5 are my favourite episodes. And they're the ones which have got the most in common with each other, I think.
I think 3, if we're picking the best of that small bunch, I like 3 best.
Anyway,
don't like the dinosaur one. Don't like that one.
You don't like the dinosaur one. Well, nah, we'll get
I'm not, I'm not convinced.
I love the dinosaur one because for the preview beforehand where we see them end up in the dinosaur world, it's done in a very realistic fashion. But then literally as the episode starts, Sashi is the first person to notice that it's almost like a Flintstones version of Dinosaur World, where everyone is slightly cute and all the volcanoes flex and bend as they just vomit up clouds of steam.
See, for me, episode 5 was like a milestone as when the series start to grate on me slightly. It was at this point I thought, right, I'm sick of seeing this world-to-world thing. I want to see something going on that's not just them going from a quirky little area with little pop culture references. But I'm a sucker for the pop culture references, don't get me wrong, I love that, but...
You've just described the average season of Quantum Leap. You know that.
Whoa, no bad Quantum Leap words. I love that.
Yeah, so episode 2 is directed by Masayuki Kojima, who worked on Mask and the Real Ghostbusters when he was younger.
Ooh.
And he also directed Monster.
Oh.
And Master Keaton.
Hmm. He's also a director for... Oh, God. He's a director for DNA Sites 9999. I remember falling asleep drunk to that movie once. It didn't improve. I can tell you, as I got drunker. I'm looking at it. He's director for The Piano Forest and also Tibetan Dog, the movie. I need to see this movie.
Tibetan Dog?
Yeah, it's
pretty recent.
I'd say so too. I think we would have known about it if it hadn't been any older than that.
Mm.
And I think the animation director, was it storyboard? I wrote down Hiroshi Shimizu. Animation director. And they've been working... they were on the new Lupin series. I think they've been doing some work on that. And they also worked on Michiko Tehachin as well.
Mm.
Because there's a lot of names in this who are doing good stuff very recently.
I have to say, I'm trying to remember the name of the episode. I don't know it specifically, but it's the episode in which It's the episode in which Sashi is trying to find a spell, and I don't know his name, but I'm right in assuming that the person who directed that sequence was the guy who did Dead Leaves. Because the animation in that one,
Hiroyuki Imayashi did episode. He did everything on episode 3, pretty much, and he also did animation direction and storyboard on the Hollywood episode.
Yeah, I have to say his artwork is very stylized. Mm. So if you're used to the way the animation style in Abanabashi is, when you see that sequence, it will totally jar every single scene beforehand. But it's gone just as quick. It's almost like they discarded after this one sequence.
Which I was disappointed about.
Yeah, because I don't mind. A lot of people don't like his art style. I think it's one of the most fascinating art styles you can possibly have in anime. It's so off the wall and it doesn't conform to any kind of aesthetic. It's wonderful. It's brilliant.
I love the look, but I'm not that big on Dead Leaves.
Yeah.
Just saying.
I'll get to that episode. But I think the one problem, I think Kojima's style direction is a little too realistic for the D&D world. But I still quite like that one. I still think there's nothing good gags and ridiculousness going on in it.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But compared to episode 3, which we'll talk about next, which is the sci-fi episode.
Glorious.
Yeah, where they just go all out.
And there is so much of Gurren Lagann in that episode. There is just so much of it. And it's like almost like a blueprint for what's going to happen in Gurren Lagann. Just like scenes and stuff.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, the scene in which the ship crashes into the colony, they're basically ripping off of the Arcadia from Captain Harlock. Because there's like a skull and crossbones painted across the front of the bell.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't watch this one with the notes on because I suspect I wouldn't be able to see the cartoon from the sheer how quickly all the references come.
Yeah, they're just and they're so the rep are so fast they just come and they go.
Yeah, and what's the Gurren Lagann stuff to notice? Oh, the enemy mecha is Daimongar is basically has a big face in its body, like the all the mecha in Gurren Lagann, almost like the uniforms the Abeno Angels wear, sort of have shades of what Yoko eventually ends up wearing. The boomerang attack, which appears again in Gurren Lagann, and even at the very end, you've got nesting, basically robots inside robots inside robots, which come out of each other to do the final attack against the bad guy spaceship. So that's not even references of things. That's things which he's then going to use again later in Gurren Lagann. I can't remember if he's got the pick, because there's like a face in Gurren Lagann that he used in Cutie Honey. I didn't check whether he used it again here. But I mean, I quite like Dead Leaves, but I think this is much better than Dead Leaves.
It is, definitely.
In terms of structure and just loading up on gags.
Because at this point I was thinking, oh, this is like... Because as I say, I'm a sucker for like references to stuff and just like, you know, little nods to things. And then I was like, oh, this is really exciting. So I was just getting thrown about at this point. Three episodes in, we had the first episode where someone... Well, you know, falls from a building is quite sad. And then the second one, I was kind of, and the third one was just awesome. It's so exciting, and it just looks glorious.
Yeah, I think at the time I saw it, this was like the point at which I kind of learned to stop worrying about when animation goes off model. It was like, okay, fair, do whatever the hell you like. Because, I mean, episode two is different from episode one, but in terms of character design and stuff, they're fairly close together. But yeah, this one sort of goes so far out its way. I mean, it's... I know the episode 12, which he did, you can see his influence, but because he's not directing it, it's a bit more toned down than episode 3 is.
Which one's 12 again?
Hollywood.
Right. We need names rather than numbers. Hollywood.
Yeah. And then, after that, unless you've got any more comments about this episode you want to make...
I'm looking at my notes here. I've got my notes because I watched these episodes like last week, and I've put, "Where's the soundtrack gone? Where's that song from the start gone?" And at this point, I was like, "No, okay, I'll let you off this time." But no.
The only note I have here for this episode is Miss Aki is not getting any more attractive.
Oh, you wanted to talk about Mooney, who's obviously shows up in episode 2. We haven't mentioned her.
Yeah. So, like, okay, I have to just take a little side segue out. I have this love hate relationship with Gainax. Okay, every 5 years they come up with something that that I really really like, and they're so on the ball, they're so good at their job, and then they literally, it's almost like they forget how to do their jobs for 5 years, and they just make absolute trash. Like, this is the same studio, you know, you can hate it, you can love it. This is the same studio that gave us FLCL and Ava and so on. But it's also the studio that gave us He Is My Master, which is the most god-awful, wretched trash you'll ever watch in your life. So you're trying to, and you're like, but these are the same people doing the same job over and over again. How can they do this? But then they'll do something like Abenobashi, where it's like, we're not even trying here. We're just... flexing our muscles, and I really, really love this. But one of the things that they're famous for is they're crazy about pretty girls. Like, if you go back to their earliest days, their entire thing was, we know how to animate realistic looking girls. Now, please, we can argue about how realistic it is for a girl to have a waistline that's 6 inches wide, but their whole thing is they love cheesecake depictions of girls, and I'm happy to say, or unhappy to say, depending on which way you subscribe, that Mooney is their continuation in this show. And okay, so does anyone want to just say the most obvious thing about Mooney?
She's got pink hair. Is that what you're referring to?
She wears glasses.
Yeah.
Where are you getting that?
Your points are all very equally valid. However, the thing about Mooney and the whole gag line with her is that she's incredibly well endowed, and every chance she gets, she hugs Sashi, much to his companion's great annoyance. Now, Mooney is kind of like, we'll get into her a bit more and I don't know how to dig myself out of that comment any more than I already have just dug
myself
out.
I'll jump in that hole with you.
Okay, so we'll get into the whole point about Mooney Mooney, and there is like a dead serious point to Mooney Mooney's character. As much as she's used as comic relief, there is a dead serious point to her. But the whole point about Mooney Mooney is she turns up in every single episode. She hugs Sashi. She usually points him in the way of some sort of quest item to get to the next quote-unquote level, so on and so forth. But another thing is that she's looking for someone, and we'll talk about the other person in a little while later. But as Mooney Mooney goes on, it's literally like the writers are letting bits of her storyline fall off for us to pick up. And it's only in the last, what will we say, the last episode or two, that it finally crystallized into the whole point of her character.
Yeah, we should also mention she doesn't appear in episode one.
Yes, because which is they haven't jumped yet.
As we go later. But yeah, watching it again this time round, episode one is laden with foreshadowing when you watch it again, after you've seen all the way up. There's just loads of things which own kind of have take on extra meaning once you know various things have happened. And we should, yeah, when they're going between these worlds, they're trying to get their way back home. They have to follow a quest that Mooney Mooney normally gives them, and then they, which is normally to find some sort of, do they call them demons or imps? Goblins, that's it.
Yeah.
Who will then draw them a magic circle and send them on their way.
Or at least they're intentionally trying to get home.
Yes, but in these first few episodes, after they've gone, the creature then says, oh, I've got to do this, I've got to do that. And so at this point in the series, you think it's these goblins' incompetence that's causing them to fail to get home.
Yeah, and then I think by the fourth or fifth episode, the kids have cottoned on to the fact that the goblins keep making a mistake, and they keep trying to correct the goblins' behavior, but it doesn't make any difference. They still end up in an entirely insane world anyway. And after, I think, episode seven or eight, the kids just give up trying to get it right. In fact, they actually start drawing their own circles in an attempt to evade the goblins' incompetence.
So after they've been to science fiction Abenabashi, which is their Abenabashi, which is this shopping arcade, and in this case, that's all there is in the world. It's sort of floating in space under a dome. They end up in Hong Kong Abenabashi.
Oh, it's a great episode.
I've got a name here which I wanted to mention. Kyo Taka Ohata did the storyboard, and they've done a lot of stuff recently. Done a lot of stuff, less good stuff for Gainax. Been doing a lot of stuff on that Natsumi's Book of Friends, on Bacano and Do Ra 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 Ra, Azumanga Daio as well.
Yeah, and please, I'm not even looking at the ANN. I know about this gentleman, and you're going to hate me for this, but Ohata is the entire episode length director for all of Sister Princess. And I only know this because I own Sister Princess. God help me, I don't know why I own Sister Princess, but I own it, and I know that he's the director. And what can we say?
You're so traumatized, his name. So
it's just God almighty. But yeah, he's a good director. From what I could see, he's a pretty good director.
But yeah, he's just storyboarding this. I don't think the other people have got much to their name that's worth mentioning. And this is definitely a step down from 3 and 2 in terms of animation. But it does have some very good gags.
Very, very good. Very good.
When I saw the title of in the preview, you know, Abenabashi Hong Kong Martial Arts Shop, I was like, oh great, they're going to do a John Woo episode. And I was like, no. What the hell? It's all black and white. Why did they? And I was like, ah, now I get it. Within 10 seconds, I'm like, okay, I'm shifting gears, and we're into Jackie Chan miracles territory, where he takes on kind of 1920s Hong Kong. And I, after a couple of minutes, you kind of get into the rhythm of it. And I have to say, the best conceit of this whole episode is that we keep being told that the Pelican Gang are, you know, are doing evil, malicious things, like Mooney Mooney and Sashi's sister turn up as police officers, and they keep telling my mind's gone blank. The girl,
Arumi.
Oh, thank you. I keep seeing her name, I keep forgetting. They keep telling Harumi that the Pelican Gang is like trading in this evil, evil, evil material. And then about 10 minutes in, we find out the evil material they're talking about is snails. It's a great letdown, though. I mean, it's fantastic.
Is there any payoff for that? Because Moody Moody's afraid of snails. And yeah. Is there anything else?
That's it.
Yeah. it's not really going anywhere.
Yeah, it's like one of those standard Gynax tropes of we're going to set something up, we're not going to pay it off, and screw you if you think I'm going to pay it off.
Yeah, and then they sort of, it goes from Jackie Chan, Bruce Lee, and then they start parodying manga Kenshiro. And anime, which refers... Yeah.
Kenshiro, that was one of the greatest Kenshiro references. I was just in a
I have to say, that's my favourite bit. Mm. Like, he gets tougher and tougher, and then suddenly we don't see Sashi for a couple of minutes, and when we see him again, he's Kenshiro. And, like, Rumi keeps looking at him, kind of...
And the Bruce Lee jumpsuit, throw that on anything, and I'll have a little smile, a little grin. You know,
yeah.
Big, big Bruce Lee fan, so... but other than that, this is the point where I'm kind of like, right, do something, please. That's not these worlds. I know I'm only 4 episodes in, but I'm a tough cookie at times. I'm sometimes really easy impressed, but I was very critical. Maybe I was tired from work. I don't know, but I wasn't playing along. I wasn't playing ball games.
See, because when I was originally watching it, I was watching it weekly, and so I was like, oh, where are they going to go next?
In that regard, probably how it's meant to be watched, it probably works a lot better.
It's in your delivery, like, Anthony, oh, where are they going to go next? Brian, where are they going to go next?
that's it would probably work a lot better, whereas I kind of marathoned them slightly.
One of the things that I did like about it is, and Gynax are these weird kind of sexist pigs, guys, because... on one hand, they're completely sexist. On the other hand, they're very equal in their delivery. So the scene in which Mune Mune turns up for the first time, it's done in this really slow-mo as we see both of her breasts jiggling, going right towards Sashi, and you're going, that's really sexist. But just to even things out, Grandpa Masa turns up at 2 minutes later, and they animate him in exactly the same manner. It's brilliant. And you can see Sashi in both angles going, as Mune Mune comes towards him, he's like, yay! And as Grandpa Masa comes over, no! It's brilliant.
And then, of course, in episode 5, they find themselves in the best genre, caveman. As we have established on this podcast before, caveman stories are better than science fiction stories.
Ain't that the truth?
There's one joke in this I've just got to get out of my system, where there's naked Sashi and he has the little elephant face over his penis.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Just rolling around. So dinosaurs aside, setting aside, you can throw that gag at anything and I will laugh at an elephant's trunk covering a penis.
Also, right after that scene happens, we have that that whole thing between Harumi and Sashi where Harumi makes this reference to something being little, and Sashi freaks out and starts demanding to know what did you mean by little.
That goes on for a little while, actually, and I was
and then she shoots him down and goes, are we finished talking about your wee wee now? And he just freaks out completely. It's brilliant.
This is one of these episodes where those ADV notes fall down, because you're watching it and I'm like, okay, there's loads and loads of references in the background to that 1970s caveman show. I want to make sure I'm about to pronounce it completely incorrectly. There was two versions. One of it is like named after the Gyatorus, something like that. Lots of the character designs of the background cavemen are based on that. And no mention of it at all on the ADV disc. And there's another thing later on where they reference, I think it's in the War one, and they say, this is a reference to XL Saga. You're like, I bet it's not. I bet that's just what XL Saga were referencing something in the first place. Nothing can possibly be a reference to XL Saga, because it's entirely made up of references. But they are quite helpful otherwise, apart from that. And they did point out the Tex Avery reference, which is where they're being chased and keep hiding behind increasingly small...
I did like that. That was good. That
rocks.
Was good.
Yeah. Until they get to the kind of like a camel-like dinosaur, and the dinosaur is just struggling under the weight of all of them. It's great.
That was good. That was
I'm sure there must be other Tex Avery things through that, because they give him, they actually name check him
his name, yeah,
later on. And I mean, the last episode's got a huge Chuck Jones, massive Chuck Jones reference. But we'll get to that when we get to the final episode. And also, I noticed that this is where the plot starts to appear. You start to see it through the goofery. I think, is this where a rumor starts suspecting what's actually happening?
Yeah, and at this point now, the Mister who keeps turning up in all the episodes.
Oh, we forgot to mention him, didn't we?
Oh God,
there's so much of it. It's like so easy to miss a bit until it all start. You have to start mentioning them. Yeah, so
he turns up. He turned up in episode 2 and he gave Urumi the little amulet, which Urumi keeps on not mentioning what its actual power is until the last couple of minutes when Sashi demands the amulet to slay this ginormous demon, which is a huge suit of armor, and it causes the suit of armor to grow breasts. And then it's like, ah, now the penny drops. And then he turns up again in the intergalactic episode. Now, I can't remember what his role in the intergalactic episode was.
I don't think it's much. No, I don't think he does much in that.
I don't think it amounts to very much. Then he turns up again in the Hong Kong one as the guy outside the main auditorium, and he gives him the suit that Anthony was mentioning.
And doesn't it turn out the receipt is the actual thing they need rather than the...
That's right, the tag.
Oh, it's the tag, yes. The tag is the actual...
Yeah. And then he turns up in the dinosaur episode, and he actually has definitive dialogue in the dinosaur episode where he has a plot and he has an arc to complete, and that's when we first realize that he's not just another background character who keeps turning up. There's a definitive reason that why he's there.
I never liked him. Never liked him. Well, almost forgot about him.
I was prepared. Most of the characters, apart from one character, I think most of the other characters of the show don't particularly like him either until the
I don't think I'm meant to like him. I don't think I'm meant to think much at all until later, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Which is when it gets good, I'm just going to say.
Yes. Now,
so we've done dinosaurs.
Okay. We've gotten the bits that Anthony doesn't like out of the way.
Yes. Now, the film
noir. And then we're treated to
Detective.
And I'm sorry, folks, for messing you around. I actually mixed up the episodes, the Hong Kong episode with the In the Night Fog, which is the hard-boiled detective story, and I mixed the two of them up, so my apologies for mixing them up.
That's all right, don't worry.
It's fine. But I was loving this straight away, because I love detective flicks, I love a film noir, and I just love like a big trench coat and one of those hats, those detective hats. Yeah, and then it kind of just goes a bit off the beaten track with some silly plot. I like the idea, because basically they wake up, well, I say wake up, they end up in this, as you say, like hard-boiled, what town is it, in London, or?
Yeah, I think it's described as kind of Chicago, that kind of.
Ah, right.
Chicago. Because then everyone's got, you know, Tommy guns, they're all hanging out in a nightclub, that sort of thing.
That's right, yeah. I can't remember what happens to kind of, I think the grandfather's is the grandfather a cop or something, or a leader of the other gang, and Sashi gets mistaken as a sniper that's been hired to kill.
He basically gets mistaken as Golgo 13.
That's right, I did. He's called Rogo.
Rologogo.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, it's actually Arumi's dad who's the.
Yeah, it's Arumi's dad.
Right.
And the joke is even though he's the right one, he can't actually hit anything.
Yeah, he needs dynamite to actually finish off his target. And Sashi actually, by accident, is a better shot at everything he does, but it's all by accident.
Which kind of is another clue to actually what's going on, I think, in terms of that he's actually the competent one.
Yeah.
And then it's just the bit that I was kind of thinking, oh, all right, okay, this is all right. I like the setting. That's a tick. And then when someone gets shot, they deflate.
SD version of themselves. And once you're an SD version of any character in this episode, no one pays the blindest bit of notice to you at all.
Oh, yeah, but don't try shooting them again. See what happens then. But I was in the final shootout, like the two gangs or whatever, they're all getting filled with lead and then shrink into.
And I love how when they're shot, they shrink down, and then the two SD versions of both sides start running towards each other and start pointing at one another, furious at each other.
Well, wouldn't you if you got shrunk? I wouldn't.
Yeah, I would.
Now, looking at who worked on this, I'm wondering whether this was what got him the... Because the storyboard artist is Tsunao Katabuchi, and he went on to direct all the Black Lagoon anime. And also write it and storyboard a lot of it and do a bunch of episodes of it. I can't see anything hard-boiled about his previous work before this, like Lassie. So I wonder whether it's like, yeah, okay, you're the hard-boiled guy now. You did a great job. It's time for you to do Black Lagoon. Whereas director is Hiroki Ochi, who did Armitage the Third, the OAV at least. And Polymatrix. What's the difference between Polymatrix and Deal Matrix? Never actually watched the movies. Am I the only one who actually watched Armitage the Third?
You are. Well, you are. I speak on behalf. Yeah, you are.
Price of being old. It was exciting when it came out because it was one of those cheapo VHS, like $6.99 or something per episode, like Guy used to be.
That's cheap VHS. Jeez.
Yeah, it is.
It was back in the day. That was like. That and Giant Robo was keeping me going in 1996.
1996, wow. Yeah.
Holding everything together there.
This isn't one of my favourite episodes, I don't think. I do like the gags, but...
I like the end of this better than the kind of initial setup when you're kind of... Because this is where they start to realise that, you know, that it's Sashi that wants to be there.
Yeah,
this is when it starts to come into place that they both don't actually want to go home. Sashi, it's basically him that's... Is it this point, isn't it? I'm sure it is.
Yeah, it's just, I think it's
the very end.
Yeah.
And then I was kind of like, ooh, I get it.
And we're kind of told by the mister, he's kind of like, one of you doesn't want to go home. That's the whole point of the exercise. And so... Rumi kind of is in this episode. She kind of confronts Sashi about his behavior, and Sashi says, "Okay, fine." And they warp out, and we expect that, you know, they're going to warp out to something else. And then we get to this point, and I remember you were saying this to me, Anthony. I think in one of your tweets, this was at the point where you were kind of running out of steam, because now we have the flashback episode and. The flashback episode is actually, for me personally, when you, like Brian was saying, when you kind of rewatch it and watch the first episode and then you watch the last episode, the bridging episode between the two is the flashback episode, because it actually explains the whole point of the exercise.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And then when you think about it again, it confuses you even further.
Yep. Because there's lots of references in the first episode that when you go back again, oh, that's what that meant. And then you went, wait, hang on a second, the flashback episode kind of contradicts it. And it's almost like, and we will get to it, one of the characters, and Brian and Anthony both know what I'm talking about, one of the characters in question who's important in the final episode, it's almost like we're seeing his rose-colored version of the flashback of said events. Mm. Because the only other person who has any kind of third party experience is another character. I hate doing this.
Just do it.
Okay, fine. So Mr. Abeno, he has direct knowledge of the events in which the flashback episode take place, and you actually see it from his perspective. And I think is it the second last episode? We see his version of what happened, and it's slightly different to how Grandpa Master remembers it.
Yeah, so basically episode one, at the end of episode, near the episode one, Grandpa Master fell off a roof, and then we see him in hospital, bandaged up, with bandage around his head, bandage around his face. He's in some sort of coma.
Mm.
In the start of this episode, he's awake, the bandages are removed, it looks like he's been listening to something on headphones, and then he starts to reminisce about when the arcade was set up, and where he met this mister who's been... in the previous episodes, who was an architect and helped him get money to start the restaurant that he runs.
That's right.
In this new development of the Abenobashi Arcade. And...
So I just want to say, I think it would have been perfect if they just had episode one, and a second episode, which kind of had two worlds, maybe, and then jumped straight to episode seven.
You would have liked it if they had skipped the intervening episodes.
Yeah, I don't know which ones in particular. I'm not that harsh. Maybe just combine them somehow, but kind of shrink at this point, shorten the show.
I actually think that it's the other way around for me, at least personally. I think the flashback episode would have worked better if it had been the second last episode, because the kids would have jumped towards their final destination in the 11. The 11th episode. You would have had the flashback episode to explain everything, and then you would have had the 13th episode to resolve everything the flashback had set up. That would have worked better for me.
That would have certainly worked, definitely, but I just think if it had waited that long, I would have been hating my life.
When I first watched it, I felt that this was in the wrong place. And I was like, okay, what are they doing to us now? Why isn't this them jumping into some wacky world anymore? But watching it again now, because of some of the screwy things in this episode, it's actually in the best place, because if it was right before the finale, it'd be more obvious the strange things which are carrying on, and you'd be going, how does all that work? It would confuse the ending even further.
It would be very confusing,
because I should say the fall in the first episode is represented here exactly the same in the seventh episode. By the time the series is finished, we'll get two more versions of that fall. And also, there's an odd thing in that we see him in hospital here. He gets flashed back to the 1950s. Did it say exactly which year in the 1950s it was?
No, it just says 50 years ago. And then the only other information we have is 45 years later. And a reference to his wife dying.
Yes. Mm. And then we see him walking about at the end of the episode. Then you first think, okay, he's out of hospital now. But then you see
Little Rami and
they're younger. And then you go, I'm not sure what's going on here. Yeah. I have a theory, which I'll get to when we get to the last episode.
Okay.
I'm not sure it entirely holds up, but there's... it's very confusing. But there's, as we're going to learn, everything is very, very confusing in this show. And it's not entirely...
There seems to be like a deliberate attempt at confusion in this episode, where it's deliberately screwing with you, because right afterwards, except for, like we were saying, the now red herring angle where we know Sashi doesn't really want to go home. Mm. And that's why they keep jumping to these insane places. But other than that red herring, it's almost like the flashback episode happens and then they just go back to business as usual, despite the fact that the audience now knows that there's something deadly serious going on in the arcade that's beyond the wacky hijinks, ha ha ha, he keeps falling into Mune's breasts, that sort of joke all the time. There's something dead serious about it. And there seems to be a deliberate attempt by the show's runners to actually do this. It's not
mission accomplished, because... Yeah.
So in this episode, we learn the relationship with Master and Benno, and is Mooney appears in this as well?
Yeah, she is.
And is it this episode where it's clear that they were both in love with her?
I don't think it's too... Is it?
It's not made entirely clear from this episode, because we know
he just finds their shoes together, doesn't he? And then he plans to stab him.
That's right, yeah. As you do.
Yeah, it's like, hang on a second, she could have been helping him fix dinner, or he could have been showing her how to install a light bulb. He was going to stab somebody for that. I want proof, damn it. I want him to run in and open the door and go, ha, you're not playing pachinko. Something, anything other than that.
Yeah, okay, yeah, so not this episode. They haven't explained why there is more of a reason than that as to why he's going to stab him. Which I think is that episode 9, or is it later than that?
I think it is 9, actually.
But anyway, episode 8, we get a parody of Renai Games.
This is, like Anthony was saying, like the dinosaur episode is not one of his favourite episodes. This is my least favourite episode of the whole lot.
The animation's a bit rough.
I think it's just... Like, okay, so for those of you who don't know, Gainax, in another life, perfected the dating sim set in a school Like, they actually marketed a whole line of games based on the I want to date any number of amazingly attractive 14-year-old girls in high school. They're experts at this. And you can see them deliberately screwing with us in this episode, going...
I don't think they're even taking the mickey out of any of their own, either. I think it's all other people.
Yeah, it's like, we're not even going to try and parody our own work. We're just going to parody the cliches that we've invented in this episode. Ha-ha! Isn't it great? But the other thing about the episode is that Arumi... In the episode beforehand, in the kind of the Chicago hardboiled detective story, she's the only one who doesn't get shot and turned into an SD character. And poor old Sashi spends most of the second half of the episode whining to anyone who will listen, and no one does listen, by the way, that he's this SD character and nobody likes him and nobody cares about him. And she's kind of like, ha ha ha. And it's like the writers were kind of, the week after they did the writing for the flashback episode, were like, we really should pay off that scene. And so in this episode, because Sashi is this lecherous, testosterone-driven teenager, he gets paid out because he's now the central character in this dating sim episode, and Arumi gets treated to being a little tiny goblin.
And didn't she get pecked by a chicken? Or a...
Yeah, I don't know what the reference to the chicken
was. I don't know either. I wear sunglasses. I don't know.
Yeah, that confused me as well. I assume it must be some deliberate specific match, because on the notes, it points out loads of things are specific references to very specific events in very specific games. But I don't think they mention what the chicken is.
I don't know what the I haven't got the ADV disc with the notes on it, but the minute I saw the chicken, I was like, he's wearing chains, that's one tough chicken. He's...
He means business.
He means business.
There was a mole with shades on as well earlier, wasn't there, in earlier episodes?
Yeah, there was.
But moles always wear shades. It's well established. Chickens less so. He's not fat and round enough to be a Goo Goo Ganmo reference.
No. But like the episode kind of progresses as Sashi gets more and more wrapped up in the kind of, I know I'm in a dating sim game. And he actually starts to figure out, well, if I do this and do this, then I'll get the circle revealed and we'll find out who's a goblin and we'll be able to get out of here. But halfway through it, he kind of decides, oh, no, I should really date this girl. And you can see Arumi kind of starting to have a small meltdown. As around the halfway point, she starts to have this minor meltdown because she's starting to be tired of being pecked by the chicken and having to deal with Sashi, you know, hanging out with all of these brainless airhead girls. And she finally, like around the halfway point, you can see her literally starting to crack.
Yeah, because he says he just wants to finish the game, and then after he's done that, he refuses because he says, I want to get a different ending. But I think I can go back and try and get a better ending than this, because it's one involving somebody ascending to heaven or something ridiculous.
Yeah, like, and I love how that girl you're talking about, whatever her name was, who's ascending to heaven, literally as she's ascending to heaven, they're bolting bits onto her character, like, oh, and I have cancer, and I'm a robot.
I actually don't remember this bit. I think this was the episode where I was kind of like mentally turning off to try and write notes about something more important about the series. And then I really didn't like this one. I don't like the dinosaur episode, but I really don't like this episode.
Yeah, this was directed by Mitsuyuki Masuhara, who is currently directing Polar Bear Cafe.
Oh, I don't believe it. I apologize.
But he also directed the episode 12 of the Hollywood episode.
Ah, he so certainly redeemed himself.
We might have to put the blame on the animation director or a storyboard artist.
He's also
the storyboard artist on this, so we could blame him for that as well.
Yeah, he's a director on Shigurui Death Frenzy. He's also a director. yeah, and he also is a director on Kabuto and High School of the Dead. So, yeah, he really is. He's a varied career. Let's put it to you that way.
He's very much. Who's doing? Yeah, a lot of them are Madhouse stuff, isn't it? So he must be a Madhouse guy. I assume Polar Bear Cafe isn't Madhouse because a lot of people aren't at Madhouse anymore.
Well, at the moment in regards to this show. I've got episode 1, episode 2, and then that would go straight to episode 7, and then there is no episode 8. And then we're on episode 9. So at the minute, I've got a four episode series. That'd be my perfect show so far.
Episode 9, we get another ton of exposition dropped on your lap. It cries the bush warbler. Basically travels with Abeno back to Heian era Japan. He's got loads of modern mod cons in there as well.
There's a helicopter.
Yeah, they go back in the helicopter.
He's got a Huey helicopter, and he's got modern conveniences. And we should just kind of roll backwards slightly and say that at the end of the other episode, of episode 8, Urumi finally loses control completely and utterly. And actually, in the doing and throwing, she grows to this kind of Godzilla level sized dinosaur. She trashes everything around her, stomps off into the distance, and it goes off crying. And then at this point, Mr. Abeno turns up and actually says to Sashi, "Look, I can tell you how to fix this problem, but you're going to have to come with me." And at that point, we then segue into episode 9, and we realize that Mr. Abeno has been basically had the power all along to fix the problem, but as he explains to Sashi halfway through the episode, events happened centuries before you were born that made sure there's no way you can fix this problem.
Yeah, because we also learned that he's actually the historical figure Abeno Seimei, who is a Onmyoji, who is a specialist in Onmyodo, which is like a mix of all sorts of astrology, feng shui.
If we're going to summarize him, he's like an 11th century version of a Jedi master. That's the best, nicest, kindest way of putting it without having to explain what he does. He says spells and he can change reality. He can influence events and things like that. That's basically his whole shtick.
Yeah, and he's going to train Sashi in how to do what he does.
Share the power,
properly.
Yeah, and in typical Gainax fashion, totally and utterly reneges on training him. It's like, screw it, it's too much like hard work. Here, read this instruction manual. like, you cheap bastard.
Is this where he explains
about Mooney? Yes, he does.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the episode when he explains, you know, I knew Mune Mune back in the 50s, but that's not when I first encountered Horin Masa. So the explanation is that when he first trained to be an Omnio Mystic, he encountered both Mune and Masa, and Mune and Masa were married to one another, and he hung out with the two of them all the time, and in the toing and froing, he ended up falling in love with Mune. And it's never quite explained how Masa, in the 11th century version of himself, finds out about him and Mune. But he does, and in doing so, he kills Mune and then kills himself. And then Abeno turns up, and realizing what he's just done horribly, horribly wrong, he tries to fix the mistake. And in doing so, he takes him, Mune, and Masa out of the reality of the 11th century Heian era, and they neatly get deposited in 1950s/60s Japan.
Cue episode 7.
Yes.
Yeah,
so this episode actually references episode 7, but like Brian was saying, it also contradicts episode 7.
Mm.
Yeah, because this is the thing. I'm not sure whether he takes it out, because his era that he takes him Sashi back to is clearly full of anachronisms that either he's brought there or... So how is it? Because when he finds himself in this other world, it's never explained how he managed to get back to what is apparently his era, or even if he did, or even if where he's taken him is his era, or whether it's another fantasy like the ones Sashi appears to be creating.
It's never explained, like you were saying. It's never explained whether or not we are seeing, like, are we definitively moving backwards in time, or are we jumping through dimensions? Because he actually does say, through one of his instructions of Sashi, that it's actually possible to move between a version of reality where something happened and another version of reality where it didn't happen. But again, like you were saying, Brian, it's not clearly explained. Are they traveling in time, or are they traveling in reality? Because if they were traveling in time, like you were saying, there's bits that just totally screw with you in that regard. a Huey helicopter, electricity, television, running water, that sort of thing. And like one of the best jokes of it is that in the episode where they're in 11th century Japan and he has a Huey helicopter and electricity, he has running water, but he has no toilet paper. And there's no explanation as to why that is. But if they're moving in different dimensions, then it would make more sense. Mm-hmm. But again, like they're saying, they never actually tell you that.
I don't even think the writers know. I just think that...
Well, I'll get to it with episode 30. There's something happens in episode 13, which to me suggests that the entire... where we started episode 1 is actually just another fantasy, but not of Sashi's creation. Ooh. It's of essentially of Abe's creation.
Mind blown. And then... Are we good for episode 10? Are we moving on?
Yeah, I think that's everything I want to say on episode 9. I mean, yeah, not much. There's some gags, but a lot of it is sort of...
dead serious stuff.
Yeah, dead serious stuff.
And I did like episode 9 because it was more serious and the story was moving along. They weren't going world to world. Well-ish. Like, there was actually stuff going on. Then episode 10 happens and then it's back to basics. Back to terrible world jumping.
Yes.
I almost felt like it was like a step backwards when they could have been starting to tie up the series, but no.
But yeah, as Sashi then deliberately creates a world which he thinks will keep Arumi happy. So it's a 12-year-old boy's idea of what will keep a 12-year-old girl to want
like,
to stay
in
the world.
I like his gesture. I like the gesture behind it that, you know, he's doing it for her and trying to kind of... Obviously, it boils down to him not wanting her to move away as well and stuff like that. But I like that gesture, but I just don't like the execution.
Yeah, it's kind of like within 2 minutes of Arumi landing in Sashi land, she's like, only a moron like Sashi could come up with some place as stupid as this place. Because as more and more stuff gets dumped on her, like a lifetime supply of cars and every single game you've ever wanted for every single game console. And she's like, I'd never get through the first lot of game consoles. And she starts to realize, wait, only a moron like Sashi could be behind this.
Yeah, so it's like a fairy tale world he's created that because he thinks that's what girls like. If apparently they don't like D&D adventures, science fiction, Hong Kong fighting dinosaurs, or anything else he's been creating so far.
Yeah. This episode is kind of, it's okay, but unlike Andrew, I have to say that now that I've had a chance to digest the episodes, I realise that they return to the whole world-skipping thing, but actually they're doing the whole world-skipping thing because it's Sashi trying to build a brick wall between what he will eventually find out, and I think is it an episode or two, the reality of what they left behind. And he's trying to build a brick wall between the reality of what happened and Arumi. He does not want Arumi to get hurt. And the next couple of episodes are actually the fallout from him attempting to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because by the end of this, she's completely turned on him, which is completely, in episode 11, is reflected entirely in the plot of that as basically the two families go to war.
Yeah, because she's had enough of... She's been coddling him, and she's been minding him, and she's been excusing his behavior. And at this point, you know, after her temper tantrum in the other episode, after she was nice to him and let him play the dating sim episode out, she's now totally and utterly run out of patience, and she's quite prepared now to watch him get basically mown down by machine gun fire every so often.
Yeah, and they have a war between the two... families and their shops, and every single character gets killed off pretty much, don't they?
Everyone's like KIA, KIA, KIA. And then, you know, that they throw in references in this episode, like the biggest single episode is the Yamato episode. It's like, it's the best, right? I didn't see that one coming reference, and yet when you actually see the rubble start to fall and you see their version of the Yamato start to come into the ground. By the way, I find it amazing that this battleship comes up out of nowhere but doesn't physically move anywhere. It just keeps firing its guns in all directions, and somehow that wins the war. It's a good episode. I liked it. It has loads of references to, like I said, 1941, and it has references to Yamato. Now, I'm sure there's references, like, is the, you know, the Uncle whatever, KIA, Grandpa Masaka.
I think that's the thing they claim is a reference to XL Saga, but yeah, I'm pretty sure it's not.
Yeah, it's a real stretch. If anything, yeah. It's actually kind of a throwback to Yamato, in that every so often, whenever a major character was killed in Yamato, you'd actually be told on screen he has just been killed or she has just been killed.
Yeah, then at the end of the episode, they kind of this time I really will take you back home. But it does not work. Because episode 12, we get to the Hollywood episode, where it kind of feels at first that they've come back home, but then bits of film gradually impinge upon it. Because at first it's like an Ozu movie they walk into, isn't it, where some of the characters are in black and white and completely centered in the middle of the screen.
Before we go on to episode 12, do you want to talk about the storyboarder or the director on this one?
Oh, yes. I was just looking at that myself and then forgot it as soon as I took off the... Yeah, Seo Yamamoto is the storyboard artist, and she's currently directing the new Lupin the Third Fujikomine TV show.
Yeah, seriously, fair play. And I've seen some... she did Trava, the OVA that Redline is based upon. She did work on original background art for Redline. She's also worked as a director for Panty and Stocking, and also the aforementioned Michiko Tohachin as well. And she's kind of like, she's getting around. She's worked on Eureka 7, and she's also worked on Occult Academy as well, on storyboarding again. Yeah, she's prolific. Mm. Give that to her.
Yeah, and it was Hiroki Ochi directing again. Yeah, that's the one thing I kind of was disappointed is they didn't get, like, different episode directors for every single episode. I would have kind of liked to have seen that. They're pretty good at getting storyboard artists. To set Imahashi doubles up. But I'm not complaining about that too much.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the magical transference animation is all done by one guy as well.
When they go from
world to world, yes.
World to world.
Circle, yeah. Shinji Higuchi, yeah. Did every single one of those. I think most times it's the same animation, but a couple there's slight differences.
Do you know what they say? Is anyone gonna do the quote?
You do, because you were looking up before the episode.
Oh, I've actually closed the window. No, I haven't. False alarm, guys. False alarm. I can't do it in a Texan. Should I try it in a Texan accent?
I thought you were great at accents.
I am, Texan,
Come on, you'll never be the next Grand Tem at this rate.
Let's have a think. Texan, I can't do text, I'm just going to do it in my voice. All things extant in this world, gods of earth, gods of heaven, let them be as it should be, thus shall it be. That was a bit of Texan rolling out towards the end. I tried.
Okay, I'll have to take your word for it.
I'm going to silence on inquiry.
Yeah, so episode 12, they think they're back, but they then start getting attacked. Well, first of all, finds it was an Ozu movie, then they get attacked by various Hollywood horror movie monsters who are also their relations.
I was loving this. All these references going wild. I was trying to jot them all down. And it was difficult. North by Northwest, reference, Snake Plissken, Indiana Jones, Jaws, Terminator.
Die Hard,
Titanic, Back to the Future. But this is good.
It comes thick and fast. And next two episodes... Three, I'd say it's probably my favourite. The top three, I'd go 3, 12, and then 5, the caveman episode.
Yeah, I would have to agree. It's one of those episodes where you knew they were building to this, where they were like, let's just throw everything in a blender, guys, and see what happens.
I agree. I almost feel like the kind of, like, you know my thought. I found some of it quite boring, but I almost started to feel like they were dozing, and then they finally woke up with episode 12 and like, right, guys, we need to get as much as we can in, as you say, and just slap it together in the best way possible.
And then there's this weird bit near towards the end of the Hollywood episode where, you know, we're rushing towards everything, and then literally, is it in this episode that Sashi's dad turns up for the first time?
Yes, at the very end.
Literally, we are hammered with this moment where this bit that Sashi has been avoiding for the last couple of episodes has been trying to hide from Urumi. He can't hide anymore. And we find out for the first time that Mr. Ebeno is actually more connected to Sashi than anyone knew previous to this. So will we tell people what the whole connection
yeah,
with...
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah, he's his granddad.
Okay, he's his granddad. Basically, he and Mune slept together.
We don't find that episode 13.
So he's his granddad, and the guy who Sashi thought was his granddad for all of his life is just literally as his dad's the bloke they just brought in off the street.
Yeah, it's pretty much episode 13. You see that the episode 13 drops the 13. You get the second version of Massa falling off the roof.
And how is it different?
He just dies there and then.
Oh, right.
Okay. In the previous two episodes, it's him being hanged. So he's trying to get a cat off the pelican sign, is it, on their roof?
That's right, like the sculpture or whatever it is.
He falls down, the pelican sign hits the ground, smashing it.
Yeah.
And he's hanging from a sort of air conditioning unit. And then he goes to hospital. In this version... He hits the ground, and the pelican's hanging from the...
And it actually, what Brian was saying, you know, it's true, it gets better and better as you rewatch it, because when Sashi tells Ebeno that the pelican symbol has been smashed, you'd have thought that Ebeno would have been more annoyed or upset or scared that something had happened to the pelican. But you can actually see Ebeno, he doesn't even react when Sashi tells him that it's been smashed. And that leads you to suppose at the time that it wasn't an important thing. But now I think about it a bit more. Is it because of that?
The fact it wasn't true.
Yeah.
Mm. Ooh. Ooh.
Which then makes you think, who's having the flashback in episode
7? Oh, no.
Yeah.
What is going on?
Yeah. So... So 13 kind of we're finally laid out with the actual truth of the matter is that when Ebeno and Massa and Mune were thrown into the 1960s in Japan, like we were saying earlier on, Mune and Ebeno were attracted to each other because of their previous relationship, and also because Mune in this version was immediately attracted to him. They ended up sleeping together, but because he had caused so much harm to Massa and Mune in the first time round, Ebeno leaves this version of reality. Mune ends up marrying Sashi's quote-unquote granddad. His dad is Mune's son, and Massa ends up marrying somebody else entirely. So... I there's a bit in episode 13 where I want to talk, specifically want to talk about Mune, but basically we're told the real story of what happened 40, 50 years ago in Abenabashi, and Sashi, on top of learning all of that, is still trying to hide the fact that Grandpa Massa has died from Urumi.
Which is beautiful of him to do. It's such a nice thing to do. Like, it's a weird thing to do,
well,
I suppose.
I'm not sure it is nice, because there's the other thing in episode 13 is she pretty much lays it out of what her ambitions in life are, which is to move away from Abenabashi and even maybe go to New York. So there is a degree of selfishness.
Oh, definitely, without a doubt. But it's kind of sweet at the same time.
But he also learned that his dad had also been given a kit by...
And he said, bugger that.
Well, did he?
Because he can use this magic.
He seems to be able to use this magic and break through whatever reality that Sashi's created. And this is...
Which, at this point, I didn't know whether this was another like dream fantasy world or it was the legit father, like the real being of him.
Having said that, now that Brian said that, I do think about it a bit more. And his dad, Sashi's dad, kind of says emphatically that he said, this is a kid's toy. You're messing with a kid's toy. Stop being a kid. Mm. Grow up, for Christ's sake. You know, you can't keep hiding from life. The reality of being a grown-up. And it's almost as if Ebeno, trying to be an omniomistic blah, 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 Jedi mind power, whatever, and he's trying to correct the mistake of Masa and Mune and himself, whereas Sashi's dad has no mistake to correct, so therefore he doesn't see a need to mess around with what he describes as a kid's toy. He just gets on with the actual thing about being a grown-up.
I agree.
And so he tries to get... Well, except there's that very odd scene at the end of 7 where we see the young... Where it looks... 7, I'm sure... And I don't know, well, I'm not sure, but it does make people think that that bit at the end of 7 is him after coming out of hospital, and then why are those kids young again?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I wonder whether that's the first time that he's fallen off that.
Well, he's a doddery old man.
Yeah. And whether that's the first time somebody's had to alter reality to save his life again. Yeah. Or whether the entire carcade is designed to continually save Master's life.
Yeah.
Lucky him.
It's like, oh, great, Grandpa fell off the roof again. Oh, but do you know how many species of lizard I have to wipe out of the fossil record just to correct this mistake again? Like, I can't keep doing this. This is going to add up. But yeah.
Yeah, but he refuses to listen to his dad. But he's run out of things that he can create worlds from. And so you end up with a Chuck Jones reference from Duck Amuck, where they end up in like a completely
blank
world.
Where he's trying to scribble on a crayon.
Yeah.
You know, different drawings, and nothing's happening for him. And kind of at this point, Urumi actually mentions for the first time, you remember when your dad said about that reference to going back to reality and that I'd understand? She doesn't implicitly say she understands what it is that she's supposed to understand, but she knows implicitly, because she actually says so, whatever it was a scary thought. And at this point, this is the bit that I'm talking about that I really thought really actually sold the whole show for me, is every so often when Munu turned up in each episode, she kind of kept referencing she needed to find Mr. Abeno over and over and over again. And we thought she's just infatuated with him, you know, she thinks he's awesome. But we have this really gut-wrenching scene in the middle of some apartment somewhere. And as the scene goes on, you begin to realize they're actually standing inside Mune's apartment when she was an elderly woman. And they implicitly state this because they get Mune, okay, yes, she's in lingerie, and yes, it's 20-year-old version of Mune, but she sits down and starts smoking a pipe like an old retired Japanese person would. And she just begins looking sideways at Sashi as he begins to scream at her that, you know, this is unfair and you have no idea what it is like to try and do this. And she kind of just understands, she completely understands. And then Mune just breaks down completely and utterly and starts crying and sobbing her eyes out that she desperately, desperately needs to see Mr. Abeno again. And I don't, like with this series is always going on screwing with your perception. I can't tell if throughout this whole series we've been watching Mune's ghost traveling through each version of reality, or this is another version of Mune that implicitly knows, A, she had a whole relationship with Sashi's grandfather, she died, and now she has another chance to go and find Mr. Abeno again.
To try, yeah.
Because there is that foreshadowing in episode 1 where Sashi is leaning out of the balcony and ballast rails, and he sees an incredibly hot-looking girl who's really, really well-endowed and really hot. We never get to see the top of her head, ever. And Sashi kind of goes, wow, she was really hot. And then it's like they don't even bother to reference it again.
I forgot about that.
And she also reveals at this point that she's his grandmother.
Yeah.
I mean, you find that out earlier, though.
Yeah, but she never actually acknowledges
it. He doesn't. Oh, right. Yeah. Sashi doesn't know, though. Does he know?
He does, because
yeah,
it's
he just
still
ignores
kind
it.
Of creepy. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is her, because she's the only one, when he can't come up with another world, she's still in his blank world. So
yeah.
That she's disconnected from whatever realities people are making up around her.
Mm-hmm.
So his dad's told him to grow up, and so he does.
Literally.
He summons Ave and... Abby takes him and makes him grow up, and he grows up into... Now, this is the odd bit. Is he grows yes. up into another historical figure.
From... I did not get this reference, because I had no context for this reference.
He is... Oh, I've left the thing around. I think it's on the Abbey page. He's a descendant... Well, somebody who's claimed to be a descendant of Abbe Noseime. And he is Abbe No... Yasuaki. As a disciple of him. And yeah, I think the descendant as well, they mention here. Which then brings to the question, okay, if he's the aged version of him is somebody from 10th century. Mm. Are they actually in 2002?
Oh, yeah, goodness. You're not told, and it's left to your own devices as to whether or not this is true or not. But then, this is the weird thing. Same egg actually says, well, that's who he was all along.
That explains it.
That's okay, that explains it. Because their jobs is to predict things. So he would have already predicted that he had a descendant. Oh, he already knew him as a disciple anyway, so he'd have recognized him. But
yeah, so he actually says, that's who he was. And then he drops the reference completely, and we never are told anything else after that. It's literally...
Yeah, this is the thing, because there was still a bit of a craze for this sort of fortune telling and stuff going on at the time. There was some live action films, I think one of which came out the same year this did. There was a boom from, I think, a book in the 80s. But yeah, really the only place I'd come across it before in any great amount is in Doomed Megalopolis. Because the bad guy is a practitioner of the same thing. Yeah, so I'm not sure whether that has more resonance if you're more familiar with what they do. And even maybe the ending has more resonance if you're familiar with the same tales. Yeah, so he becomes older and then does everything that his dad told him not to do. Apparently. And that's the thing people don't like.
Why would someone not like that? I don't think it's the greatest ending in the world, but
people say it's a cop-out and they wanted Massa to die.
Like, I always like a character getting killed off because I think it's bold, and I always kind of think, right, people expect him to be brought back or saved, so yeah, kill him off. But nah, I disagree. Go on, Philip.
But having said that, I don't hate the ending because we never actually see Sashi implicitly trying to find a reality of Grandpa Massa being alive. He actually, at the end of the episode, accepts he can't change anything, and he actually hears Urumi start to cry as they start to fold space and actually go to another version of the proper original version of Obinabashi. And at that point, Sashi accepts that there is just some things he cannot change. And literally, because he accepts that change, the very thing that he's been trying to fight for, and the more he fought, the more resistance he encountered, he gets the reality he wants. Only it's this weird thing where he gets the reality he wants, and then literally it plays out normally as if nothing had ever happened.
That's right, yeah.
Well,
and everything he'd been worried about, the whole thing, Urumi moving away, the arcade being wrecked and torn down, none of it happens. But it doesn't happen like, we're just going to ignore everything that happened in the first episode and everything that he's been trying to run away with. They actually come up with logical reasons as to why none of it happens. Arumi's dad's job in the lake hotel in the north part of Japan in Hokkaido, yeah, fell through. The shopping arcade, yeah, they were tearing it down to rebuild a better, more modern shopping arcade. And everyone gets to stay where they are.
And also, Abe and Mooney Mooney also get to live in this world.
Yeah, and it's kind of like... there's a kind of a circular way of viewing things in that Abe starts to try and screw around with time and space, and as a result, he ends up screwing over both people, Mune and Massa, again. And he then goes, screw it, I'm not going to interfere anymore. I'm just going to live out my life as a dimension-hopping Jedi Master, and that'll be my life forevermore. And his grandson comes along and corrects his mistake for him by just simply running with, instead of trying to fight every version of reality, he accepts what Abe didn't. Abe actually deliberately knows what he's about to do in 11th century Heian Japan. He knows what he's about to do is going to change fundamentally the version of reality he's in. He does it anyway because he can't bear the idea that he's caused Mune and Masa such horrible, horrible tragedy. Sashi, on the other hand, tries to change events so that everything's cool, but as being a 12-year-old, he doesn't have the requisite skills to, you know, bend reality as he sees fit. So he tries his very level best in a 12-year-old way of trying to make Urumi happy. And because Sashi, in the end, accepts it, it's almost like the wrinkle in the universe that had been causing Mune and Masa and Abe so much pain and anguish just goes and just gets corrected.
And now, we also get the awesome soundtrack back in the last episode.
Yes.
That also returns. It's very. I was very sad. I was like, I tear up quite easily at things. And I was beginning to tear up when you see a Urumi cry. Because I'm very soft like that. So, but no, I think it's a decent episode. And how else could it have ended? I don't get what people are complaining about. People are going to complain regardless, but...
Well, they wanted him to learn the lesson of that as an adult, you should just give in.
But he did learn a lesson of an adult to make his own... He made a decision.
Yes.
Rather than run away. So, it's like a coin. It's one or the other. It's both are
feasible.
Yeah,
I think people want tragedy at the end, I think, is what they want.
Fair enough.
Why did this show make me cry enough?
Yeah, and insisting that he grow up, you know, I hate this ending, he doesn't grow up. He actually does grow up. He makes the most grown-up decision, and that is he decides there's nothing he can do about this situation. It's best to just roll with the decision. Mm. However traumatic it is and however much it hurts Urumi to know about this reality that's coming up to meet them, he accepts it, he runs with it, and he decides, no matter what happens, I promised Urumi I'd be there for her. That's what I'm going to do, because that's what a grown-up man does. He accepts his reality, he accepts his responsibility, and he just goes with it. And in actuality, if you think about it, right, Sashi is the only one with implicit knowledge other than Abe of what really happened, other than Urumi, because in the end of the episode, Urumi doesn't implicitly make any reference to the fact that her grandfather is now alive, as opposed to him being dead. In fact, if anything, the only person who shows any kind of implicit knowledge that anything good has happened is Sashi. So he actually it takes on the trait of an adult, because adults know the reality of – so, you know, when a tragedy happens, kids are often told half the story to shield them from the horrible truth of the matter. Adults are the ones who know the full side of the story. Sashi is the only one in the end sequence who actually knows what's happened and what he's learned from it. And it's either through writing or inaction of writing – that Urumi is not shown to have any implicit knowledge. Now, it could be that Urumi knows and she's just happy that things have just worked out.
Yeah.
It's never actually shown.
Yeah, because I think it's deliberate that she doesn't know. Because I don't think it's quite as... See, I didn't quite take the same reading as you did. I think he's kind of also being selfish in that he didn't want Urumi to... move away.
Yeah.
And she's already described at the start of episode 13 what her dreams are, and those dreams are now gone because they're not his dreams.
But having said that again, I would counter argument that with Urumi, you know, wants to get out, she wants to escape, blah blah blah, and the fact that the arcade's being torn down and her dad's moving to Hokkaido is a reason why she can get the hell away. That's not to presuppose that it won't happen in the future, that she won't move away to America and New York and then the moon, as we saw in her episode. The difference between the two is when she tells Sashi this, Sashi is dead upset because he does not want Urumi to move away. He doesn't want her because he's in love with her. I mean, it's implicitly shown he's in love with her. But at the end of the final episode, Sashi is okay with her moving away. Because at the end of the jump, just before they're about to jump into what they think is their version of reality, Sashi accepts that, again, there's nothing he can do about it. Because he knows that once she accepts that her grandfather is dead, that the other chain of events that are behind them, her dad moving to Hokkaido, the arcade being torn down, they're happening anyway. So, and as well as him accepting that he can't change, that Masa is going to die, he also accepts that he can't stop Urumi from moving away. So at the end of the final episode, it's I won't say it's implicitly stated, but because of his action in the last jump, he actually shows he's okay with Urumi moving away, because Urumi moving away doesn't mean anything. It just means she's moving away. It won't change his feelings for her. It won't change the fact that he's okay with this. So, yeah, he gets what he wants, but it's only a temporary thing. She could end up moving away anyway. She could end up going to New York anyway. The difference being is at the beginning of the show and at the end of the last episode, he wasn't okay with her moving away, or that his reality was going to change at all. From his 12-year-old version of events, he was really upset that was going to change. But by the end of the final episode, he's okay with this. He's cool. It's fine. I understand and I accept this. It's something I can't change. If she moves away, cool.
I'm not sure I agree with you, but I've been 2 weeks since I watched it, so I can't remember the details quite as accurate. So I didn't take that reading at all from the ending. I took it as sort of honourable, and but also sort of spiced with a certain amount of selfishness.
Having said that, that's my initial reading of it, and I've only just literally finished it yesterday, so I've only been able to ruminate on it for literally 24 hours. Repeat viewing may change my opinion. It's one of those weird things where the more I'm thinking about it, the more we're talking about this, the more I'm convinced that Evangelion is one of those shows where repeat viewing is supposed to do something for you. But I have to tell you, I've seen the show 5 or 6 times, and my original opinions of the show have not changed. Nothing I've seen rewatching it makes me think any differently. But the more I'm thinking about Abenabashi, the more I'm going, well, was that correct? Was I correct in that reading of the character? Is that event? Because like you were saying, that middle episode screws with your version of reality. So you have to start thinking in terms of, well, is that Masa's version of events, or is it someone else's version of events? And the more I think about it, the more the show does not make clear-cut sense as I first thought.
Yeah, that's the thing. The thing which makes me think that it's the fact that his future self, his older self, is somebody from the past, and the fact that I've read too many Philip K. Dick books makes me wonder if actually it was all to begin with sort of a fantasy imposed upon the real world. And that's why when Mooney Mooney dies, her ghost isn't of the old person, it's of exactly the same age she died in his version of events.
So because you can logically presuppose, where is the Mune that we're seeing throughout every single episode, the 20-something-year-old buxom girl, is that her from the Heian version of events, or is that her from the 1950s version of events?
Exactly.
And it's one of those, hey, wait a minute, that... And now you think about it, it makes even less sense thinking about it now.
And what would happen to Masa if he did die? And why does his dad know how to break himself out of the world? And why didn't he do it before? Was he just letting his son get along with things?
It's very complex. But as you say, it's not clear cut, but I kind of respect that it is open for interpretation, or maybe not intentionally open for interpretation. I don't know about that, but it's... Whew. Wow.
And we should say, possibly, that Hideaki Anno did the animation direction. And... yeah. Storyboards as well? Yeah, for the last episode. So that may add some of the Evangelion-like aspects of the final episode.
I have to say, since you guys asked me to do the episode, and since I've watched the series, like I said, I have a love-hate relationship with Gainax. There's a chunk of shows I won't watch that I hate, and there's a chunk of shows that I do like. I would have to say I would add Abenabashi to the stuff that I like, because on the surface, it's just about two kids jumping through reality and having wacky hijinks. And then you start thinking about it a bit harder, and you go, well, maybe it wasn't the show's creator's intention, but it unintentionally has become an incredibly deep show. And I like shows like that. I don't like, I have no problem with fluff shows that don't require any brain power, but also when you come across one of these shows where it's like, I didn't think about that before, hang on, let me give it some more thought, you realize you've stumbled onto a small little tiny nugget of a treasure of a show, and you want to hang on to it and not trying to hide it and keep it for yourself, but you're trying to figure it out so that you're quite happy with your version of the show before you pass it on to somebody else and say, you really should check this show out. It's awesome.
But ideally, as I've said before, I think episodes can be removed. So my perfect series of this, episode one, episode two,
yep.
Straight to episode seven, episode nine, episode 12, then episode 13. That would work for me. I agree with the kind of seven almost feels out of place, but at the same time, it doesn't then fit into place. But those six episodes for me would work. It would set up the characters. It would explain the whole world jumping thing. Not go into too much, but would also do the story. It depends what you want from the show, I think. But that's me.
Now, here's a question I wanted to ask. If you had the power to create alternative worlds when you were 12, what worlds would have you created? Because my actually does tie into this specifically. When I was 12, these were the things I was obsessed with. Warhammer.
Oh, God. So you'd be sat painting things in a room.
What? If you could have the real, if you have the power to create any reality, you wouldn't be sitting in a room painting stuff. You'd be like, make me a space marine, make me an orc, make me a goblin, make me a demon knight.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah.
There's worlds to invade.
Yeah, Doctor Who, because I was looking at it, when I was 12, it would just be in the time when Sylvester McCoy took over.
Okay.
Discworld, I think I was obsessed with at that time. And here's the big one, is X-Men comics, and particularly Excalibur, which went into a storyline probably a year after I started reading it, which is very much like a Benabashi. It's called The Cross Time Caper. And basically, the team of Excalibur were Captain Britain, Nightcrawler, Kitty Pryde, Rachel, and Megan. They found themselves going from alternative reality to alternative reality, where they'd meet versions of themselves and their friends in various themed worlds. So there'd be a fantasy world, there was an anime-themed world, and it also dragged on too long. It's the same way many of the complaints you were making about A Better Bashy Anthony are exactly the same complaints I was making about The Cross Time Caper when it was coming out. And also, it was perfect for when you're 12-year-old, because Chris Claremont writing X-Men comics is total puberty feel.
See, in terms of me, when I was 12, I would certainly not have a dating sim. Like, I did not think of girls at that age. I'll have it be known to all.
Oh, don't do that for a second.
Or
have you just been making up for it the past few years?
Yeah, I've just gone, you know.
Shenanigans, I call shenanigans.
I'm serious. I've had more interesting things at that age. Like,
I will say that some of the interests of, in particularly how they manifest themselves, seem a lot more like the interests of
18-year-old
people who might work at Gainax than a 12-year-old.
Yeah, because I was thinking to myself, like at 12 years of age, I mean, I was a pretty smart kid at 12, and I would have had great, you know, constructive fantasies, but nothing as elaborate as Sashi's version of events.
Oh, ones which would necessarily make references to Tokyo Story, which was
I remember I saw that bit in that episode where everyone's talking in stilted terms and everyone has a line and then there's a pause and there's another. I was like, holy crap, they're referencing Tokyo Story. I don't believe how they can they keep this up. Yes, they can. When I was 12, I'm trying to think. When I was 12, I probably would have had realities similar to what Brian was saying, except for me, I'd probably be totally obsessed with doing my own version of Jurassic Park, because that was was the movie that came out when I was 12.
How old are you, Philip?
I am 30.
Right. Oh, I'm always the youngest. Always. Just not on. But good call in Jurassic Park.
So I would have had a rolling, you know, Windows demo of Jurassic Park just as far as the eye could see. I probably had some version of events where I would lead the A-Team and Airwolf in missions in which we would defeat American versions of communism week after week.
I hope your Jurassic Park universe would be better than the dinosaur episode on Ben Obashi.
Oh yeah, it'd be far more closer to Cadillacs and dinosaurs than anything else. It wouldn't be, it wouldn't be Flintstones. It'd be more Cadillacs and dinosaurs. But yeah, I have to say, Sashi's a pretty advanced kid. If nothing else, you could say his version of reality is there. It's pretty advanced. I have to say, fair play to the kid. I mean, I wasn't that well constructed at 12.
He was like so many interests as well. I was like struggling to come up with. What was I interested in? I know X-Men comics and Excalibur. I remember that definitely. It was like having to go to Wikipedia to see what happened in 1987. And
still, yeah, I would have to say though, I would agree with Sashi, and I would be obsessed with girls, and especially at 12, I probably was obsessed with boobs.
I'm blushing here. See, I would have so much more innocent things than that. I used to watch Red Dwarf all the time at that age, so it would be some like sci-fi on the Red Dwarf ship, you know, three million years later, whatever.
Hang on a second, the opening episode of Red Dwarf has, you know, the infamous line, I'll never get to cradle a laughing child or hold a rose to my cheek or interfere with a woman sexually. Rima, you never used to do those things when you were alive?
Exactly. I would be... I don't know which character I would be, though. Maybe... I don't know. I don't want to get into it. I'm a mixture of them all, but I would maybe... I used to watch a lot of Bottom. Although yes. I wasn't interested in girls, I was certainly interested in vulgar language and toilet humour. So I'd probably be living with some horrible scab of a man in one of my realities. Oh, no, I played a lot of RPGs, so Final Fantasy VII related things, maybe. I don't actually remember what I was doing at 12. I certainly wasn't thinking of girls.
Said behind the anonymity of a blank screen, ladies and gentlemen.
No body language, we can't tell if he's lying.
Yeah, I've got a poker face. I'm squirming in the seat. I wasn't thinking of girls, honest.
Right, I think that's the episode.
This was an insightful episode, I think. As a summary to the show, I was kind of very indifferent after watching it, but this has opened up many opinions. It's kind of, I do actually kind of want to go back and rewatch some of it.
I would summarize it as well by saying, for anyone who's watching it or listening to the podcast, my apologies, but anyone who's listening to the podcast, you know, Ben Obashi is one of those typical Gainax shows. It's as deep or as shallow as you want it to be, because on the surface, like Brian was saying, you know, Gainax's staff are more or less 20-year-old man children. That's their whole shtick. That's how they run, and that's how they've run for over 20 years. But when you actually think about it, they're fully grown adults, quite capable of writing complex storyline. But they always package it in this kind of sexist toilet humor, 12-year-old boy version of events. That's always on the surface. You look at it and go, ah, that's puerile humor. And then you think about it a bit harder and you go, well, yeah, it's puerile humor, but beneath it, there's this kind of V8 engine of a storyline chugging along. Maybe not very fast, but, you know, it's consistent. So, yeah, like I said, you know, it's as shallow or as deep as you want it to be. And if you want to overthink things and start ascribing values, I've seen dozens of interviews with Gainax staffers who are like, if you want to think of that, that's cool with us. No problem. We don't have a copyright on your thought.
Well, yeah, that's exactly how you should watch TV and films anyway. It's like, who cares what the actual creator thought?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
a lot of the time. Anything you want to plug, Philip?
Yes, I haven't been on a podcast in a few months, mostly because my laptop previous to this blew up and died. But I think this is my first podcast back on the net in a good long while. So for anyone who's been kind of following me but not kind of up to date on what I'm doing, I'm currently writing for Otaku News, and I'm also writing for a Manga Bookshelf and Any Gamers, and I'm doing two columns where I'm attempting to get through old shows and movies and asking, you know, is it were they popular for a reason or were they unpopular for a reason? Are they as bad as people make them out to be? Are they as good as people make them out to be? And the other thing I'm doing is I'm digging my way through shoujo manga on the other side trying to figure out why I'm so pathologically scared of it. I have to say, you know, I'm doing fairly well. I'm not doing
bad. I'm used to hearing these sort of things from Anthony. He says he doesn't want to watch anything which is too girly.
And then when I end up watching it, I'm kind of like, that was really good. That was really good. I don't want to admit it, but I enjoyed that.
But, you know, like you always, you can find me on Twitter. I'm usually lurking most days of the week. If anyone has a job going, I will happily take it because I'm employed. If anyone has a job, I don't care where it is, because at this stage I'm kind of not being choosy anymore as to what kind of job
career
I get.
Teach English and career?
Yeah, I have to say, you know, because 6 months ago, I would have gone, let me think about that. It would have been like, will I have money? Yes. Will I be able to afford a roof over my head? Yes. I will take the job. Thank you.
That's what Grace, who was on now, episode 35, that's what she does. She decided, well, not getting any work in Ireland, so go to Korea and teach English.
Yeah, I was this close to teaching English in China about 4 or 5 years ago, and I'm not kidding, the school that I was supposed to go to burnt down. Took that as an omen and got the hell out.
Yeah, I don't want to work in a flammable school. Is there any bad chance to make them fire safe?
Whereabouts in Ireland do you live?
Dublin.
Right. I'll speak after. I'll speak after we're off record. Professionalism.
Anthony, anything you want to plug?
Just Twitter as normal. Antaskew, AntAskew. I think that's it, yeah.
Righty-ho, you can find us as normal at dynamiteinthebrain.com. You can find me at @awesome_engine on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook. Like us, write reviews on iTunes. Make them nice, please. You can also find my website, awesome-engine.com. I swear there will be something up about Moomins this week.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, Philip.
No worries. Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Your life's gone down the drain. Your body's wrecked with pain. There's just one thing to blame. Dynamite in the brain. Dynamite in the brain. Dynamite in the brain. Dynamite in the brain.